Probably. Yeah. So, hello. My name is Dan Ridiellis, and people tell me that I'm head of the Centre for Wood Science and Technology at Edinburgh Napier University. And what we do is we try and work out what wood is and what trees are. And I can't tell you about that because I don't know yet. But I mean, we use a formalised system of not quite knowing what we're doing called science. And science is most interesting, I think, when you don't know what the answer is. And that's why I think this is a really excellent theme for a conference, because we're talking about the future and we don't know what the future is. There's an old Danish saying that prediction is difficult, especially when it's about the future. And that sounds like a joke, because you would think, well, prediction is about the future, right? But actually, no. That saying is usually attributed to Niels Bohr, and Niels Bohr was a scientist, and he would know that that's not how science works. Science works, you make a prediction, you make some measurements, you find out that you were wrong. And then you try and predict a thing that you already know. And that's not just science, that's how humans think. So embrace being wrong, be prepared to be wrong, because being wrong is how you learn. So Endo was talking about the challenges in the last session, and it's really great to talk about the things that you got wrong, the things that you learnt. And that's really what I want to talk about now, is how to bounce off some of the things that have been said in this previous session. Where are we heading with forestry? Elizabeth is going to be talking to primary school kids in a week on Friday. And that's exactly what we should be doing. We should be going in and talking to young people about what forestry is going to be like in 20 or 30 years, because that's how we actually think about what it's going to be like. We need to tell stories. We need to get the children to imagine what it's going to be like, because the children's imagination is actually going to be better than ours. On the bus here, I looked out the window and there was a child in a carriage, little baby with a magazine. And it was like manipulating the pictures in the magazine like it was an iPad. And I thought, oh, idiot. But no, I'm the idiot, because this child is more prepared to live in the world of the future where that actually might be possible. And I'm the one that's going to be struggling. So we should be asking children to imagine what it's going to be like in the forest. If they were a forester in 20 or 30 years, what would they be doing? Tell stories about it. Use your imagination and ask children what they think. What do they value? What do they think forests should be for? Because that's, I mean, we don't ask children enough. And the forests are as much theirs as they are ours. In fact, they're more theirs than they are ours. Now, how do we think about the future? Well, the future, it's quite simple, because the future is built one year at a time, laid upon the years of the past. If only I could think of some kind of visual metaphor for that. We heard yesterday that the rotation length of trees in the UK is heading now for 30 years. Conveniently, 30 years was what I chose. And conveniently, even more, I had a picture of a 30-year-old tree that had been cut down. Let's think about what happened in those last 30 years, how much the world changed. 30 years ago was when Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. Now imagine how much has changed in our lives in those last 30 years. And all these other things that have come along, GPS, flash drives, social media, things that have completely changed the way that we live and the way that we do. So the world has moved on immensely. But the other thing that you get from looking at this slide is, my God, that's no time at all. It seems like yesterday. So the world is moving fast, and sometimes it's moving faster than we're prepared for. But the future contains the past. So in the future, we will still have things that we have now, and some of the things that we're hearing about today will be also in the future, but they'll be like the flash drives and the mobile phones. They'll be something that we don't even think about. We'll take them for granted. But the ones that I've done in red are the ones that I want to focus on here. So 30 years ago was when we started really thinking about climate change. And how much progress really have we made? Not a lot. So 30 years is not a lot of time to react to things that are coming towards us, and we need to start preparing for them now. Other things that have changed enormously is the way that we're using timber. We had in the year 2000 was really the start of the tall timber trend with the TF2000 light timber frame project in the UK. And since then, we've had every year there seems to be another tallest timber building made out of CLT. And CLT was the thing that I was wrong about. Because when that first came along, I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. Why would we use so much wood for that? I mean, I can imagine, you know, one or two buildings here and there, but who would build a house out of CLT or their bike shed? That's stupid. But that's what we're doing. We're doing it because, well, you know, architects like it, and it sort of works. And Dalston Works, which used to be called Dalston Lane, is supposed to be the largest, not the tallest, but the largest in volume CLT building in the world. We often don't realize how leading we are in the UK in building with wood. And they claim that it's 50% more carbon efficient compared to concrete frame, and they actually make a virtue of how much wood is in this building. And if you're a grower, if you're a forester, I suppose that's good news, how much wood goes into these buildings. But let's really think about this. There's 121 apartments in this building and 3,850 meters cubed of CLT. That's 0.1% of, I mean, it's not UK timber, but if it was UK timber, it would be 0.1% of the entire softwood production. So we could build 1,000 of these buildings from the domestic softwood production, which would be 121,000 apartments. That's less than half of the new homes that we do need to build every year in the UK. And of course, there's all the other things that we want to do with wood as well. So CLT, what's happening with it? Well, it was invented in the 1990s as a way to use low-grade timber. That was the idea of it. We would use lots of timber, but it would be timber that we didn't expect too much of. But where are we now? We are expecting higher grade timber in CLT. We're saying that this is a matter of routine, that CLT must be made from higher grade timber. And we also limit the number of species that can go in there. And the market demands a limited number of species. And how much thought are we putting into what happens to this wood after the end of life of this building? Probably not that much. And that's CLT, but you know, how different is this from many of the other things that we're doing with wood right now? Graham talked yesterday about all the wood modification stuff, and there was this one thing that got a lot of media attention. There was a paper in Nature about densified wood. I think the authors got the media attention because they fired bullets at this and said that it was, you know, bulletproof and you could make all sorts of fancy high-performance materials. And I want to... I mean, it was great that this got the media imagination, but there's one sentence that really stands out to me in the introduction to this, and it says, natural wood is a low-cost and abundant material. And many papers about wood begin with this, but it's not. It's not abundant. There's some of it, but still a limited resource. It's renewable. But the only difference between coal and wood is that coal was 30 million years ago or whatever, and wood is 30 years ago. But we can't go back in time 30 years any more than we can go back in time a million years. So from that point of view, we do have to deal with the fact that in the future, we're dealing with what we plant now. And it's a limited resource, and we'll be doing more and more with it, and it'll have to go further, and we need to think about wood in a completely different way. So I got these things from a technology scoping study that Arup had done. So imagine a tree 30 years from now that we cut. What will have happened in the world? Well, we will have probably had autonomous vehicles for most of that time on the roads, mixed reality, programmable materials, maybe even fusion reactors, things that will be as familiar to us then as the internet is to us now. So how will we be doing forestry? I mean, there's a lot of things that we've been talking about in this conference, and we're like, well, yeah, we can see that the technology is going in this direction in other fields, but the forest environment is too challenging, or it just won't work in the forest. But eventually it will, or bits of that will go into forestry, because it's happening in other places as well. So imagine what it's going to be like for this primary school child now, who's now working in forestry in 30 or 40 years from now. How will they be doing it? What challenges will they be facing when they do it? How will their working day go? There are things that we know about the world in 30 years from now. It will be an aging population in the UK, similar population, but most people will be older, and that's going to be the same in many other countries as well. And there will be an increased world population. In the next 30 years, there will be another 2 billion people, most of them in Africa. But they'll be more affluent, and they'll want higher living standards. They'll want to wipe their bum on paper the same as we do. So there'll be a lot more demand on wood and the stuff that forests can provide. A lot more expectations on the forest. And of course, climate change, and we don't know exactly what's going to be happening there. And there'll be legislation. We know there's going to be more legislation about the environment and carbon reduction and all of that. More importantly, there's going to be changing public ideas on what forests are for, and that's probably going to be the biggest challenge that we face, because we aren't the ones that decide. The public decide. They're the ones that are in charge. They're the ones that vote for the politicians. And if the public say that this is what they want the forest for, that's what we end up doing. Of course, the forest makeup will be different as well. We know from what we've planted in the past, we know what will be harvested 30 or 40 years from now, and it will be a different mixture of species. There'll be less spruce compared to the other species, and there'll be slightly more hardwoods. But the familiar species, the spruce in 30, 40 years, won't be the same as the spruce now. It won't be the same because climate change will have changed it. Different forest management will have changed its properties. Tree breeding, which is only going to accelerate with genomics, as we were hearing yesterday, will have changed what the wood is like. So what will that mean? It means that we have to change the way that we think about wood. Wood is abundant. Yes, but are we using it like it is a truly limited resource? Industry can focus on just a few species. I think that's going to have to change. We can continue to expect rising quality. I don't think that we can, really. We need to match quality to the need. We need to go from we want it to be super quality to it needs to be good enough, because good enough is good enough by definition. The price will remain low for basic products. I think we can already see what's happening with some of the markets right now, that certain industries are really struggling with the log prices because of other things that are coming along and changing the economics of the industry. So we will need ways of dealing with the fact that we have more variety and less information from the past experience and extensive testing. So we need other ways of dealing and sorting with the wood. And we need to get better at directing wood to the right value streams. Maybe even before the forest has reached the harvest age, we need to have decided what is the best thing to do. And we certainly have the technology available to start doing that in a few years' time. We heard about mechanization. The human, we now, are the bottleneck in the process. We're the ones that slow it down, because of our working rate and because of the limited supply of people willing to work in this industry. So mechanization and AI will come along to solve that problem. And we will start offloading some of the tasks to machines, like we're already doing and don't think about, because it's part of everyday life now. So yeah, there will be semi-autonomous harvesters, there'll be maybe autonomous forwarders or bits of the operation that do that. Maybe there will be a completely different way of doing things from how we do them now. It used to be that mechanization would be replacing the muscle work, but now mechanization is starting to replace the brain work, Are we really prepared for that in what we do and how we educate the next generation? Don't know. Robotics and AI is already here. Robots in your home. You don't call them robots because they don't look like you imagined robots would look like 30 years ago, but they are washing your dishes, cleaning your clothes, and doing all sorts of things. AI is making decisions about you and how your pension is invested and whether you can... whether you can get the bank loan or the mortgage or whatever. Some AI is making that decision. It's not people anymore. And there'll be new industries that have come along. So there'll be new industries using forest products. There'll be biorefineries making fuels and new materials. There will be increasingly competing biotic materials as well, like seaweeds and fungi coming along and displacing some of the things that were using wood fire before. And then there's the huge challenge of you know, what is going to replace plastics? We know that we have to do something about it. And, well, wood is maybe one of the only real solutions that we have for that. Do we have enough wood to replace the vast volumes of plastic, plus all the other things that we want to do with wood right now? So I want to talk a bit about the Verum Roadmap 2050, which was a combination between the kind of abiotic minerals people, the minings and the stuff, and the Forest Technology Platform. And they produced this roadmap, which is kind of like a scoping out of what our research needs should be and what our challenges are for the next 30 or 40 years. And it's quite a good read. I recommend that you have a look at it as something to open your mind to what's coming. They have four things that they're thinking about there. One is around better resource efficiency, so how we do more with what we've got. One is around circular economy, so can we get more cycles out of wood? Can we keep wood at the higher value before it's going down to the kind of particle level or the firewood level? Sustainable development, so doing this in a way that isn't going to impact on society or the environment. And to try and reduce the dependency on imports. Looking at emerging technologies, environmental challenges and societal changes that we're expecting to see. Now, raw materials are the backbone of industrial development, and they have a very strong link to our well-being, our health, our standards of living. Imagine how healthcare would work without paper towels and latex gloves. Would really struggle. And forestry is chief amongst the sources of biotic materials, so it's a huge place in the future world. And foresters right now are influencing the supply for 2050. This is 2050 already for foresters. But we also depend on the abiotic material supply, metals, minerals, fuel, aggregates. Imagine being able to do forestry without those things, you wouldn't really be able to. So you have to look at what the challenges are for other materials as well, because they will affect how we're working in the future. Now, in Europe, already we say, yes, wood is abundant because the forest increment exceeds the harvest. Yet, forest-rich countries import timber. Why do they do that? They do that, one, for economic reasons, because it's cheaper, but also because of what the Verum report calls limited availability of the required wood varieties. What does that mean? That means we don't see most of the wood. I only want that wood. Why? We focus on certain species. Should we? I'll tell you, most of the people that use wood don't know the species. They don't care about the species. They just care about what the properties are. You could tell them it's spruce. It doesn't matter to them, really. So we need to open our minds, really, and remove some of the barriers that we have artificially put on what we think that we're doing. So IT for harvesting is already here, but our main challenge is around societal acceptance. The public, the politicians, the environmental groups. That's one of the reasons why we should be going and talking to children, because they are the decision makers, the voters of the future. They need to understand what forestry is and the role that forestry will play in their lives in the future. So, yes, we already heard about information flow and data and there's a lot of technical research that needs to be going on, but we also need to understand what is the driver of public acceptance, social acceptance, and you know what is the trajectory that we're going on in terms of what people expect their forests to provide for them. Sheffield has shown us that we totally need new ways of planning and managing our green infrastructure. So it's not just about the technology, although technology is here to help us with a lot of important things. And there are some other things in there about the biotic materials as well and the processing side that I've not chosen to talk about in this presentation, but I recommend that you go and have a look at this report because it's quite interesting and thought-provoking. So to finish up, wood is the material of the future, and it's going to be the material of the future whatever we do. We're swimming in the direction of the current, but we're not making the current. So renewable is not the same as limitless. That means, obviously, we need to do new planting. I don't think anyone here would disagree with that. But we need to be planning ahead. What are we going to be doing with that wood, and how are we going to be using it? And the way that we're using wood now, we need to think about availability as being an important environmental impact assessment factor. We're not counting that now. But right now, we put it as a virtue, actually, the amount of resource inefficiency sometimes that we put into a building, because we say, well, we're locking up carbon. Would it be better to lock up carbon in one building or in 10 buildings? You know, if you're optimizing just one part of the problem, you might actually be making things worse in the wider sense. So no matter good intentions, we should be careful not actually to leave the world in a better place, to leave the world in a worse place than we found it. So we need to be better at forest fractionating, so taking the value out of the forest, the wood products and the non-wood products, and sending those to the best markets. And can our future bio-based economy be proper commensalism? So can we do it in a way that isn't harming the other species that are living in the forest? Maybe we can even go to communalism and be mutually beneficial, but at least we should try and do it in a way that isn't actually damaging. We need to think about abiotic materials because they are something that we rely on. But yeah, you foresters are the ones that have the most influence on the timber quality in 2050 and what the wood characteristics are going to be like. But we need also to think about society at large, and we don't do enough of that, as we heard in the presentation at the dinner yesterday. We're not good at talking to people, and you know, as an educator, there's certain words that we should avoid, like obviously, and as you can see, and clearly, because might be clear to me, but it's not necessarily clear to the person that I'm talking to. And actually, you know, if you try and explain something to someone, you maybe start to realize that you don't understand it as well as you thought you did. So if we can't explain it to the public, then do we really understand it? Are we doing it in the right way? Something to think about over lunch is how do we get foresters and journalists to talk to each other more and other important opinion informers? To understand what they think as much as what we think. So my final comment is that, well, forests are vulnerable to change when they cannot adapt quickly enough. This is what we know, right? Trees need our help in coping with the changing world. But we're the same. You know, we're at risk. We can only move so fast. So we need trees' help as well in dealing with the problems that are coming in the future. So that's the end of my rambles.
Thank you.